Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Two martyred American presidents sort of conjoin these dark late days of November on the cusp of Thanksgiving. Abraham Lincoln, the first president to be assassinated, spoke the most famous words of any president when he commemorated the Union dead at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, on November 19, 1863. A century and 3 days later, on November 22, 1963, President John Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Texas. So far, the last president murdered in office. There have been attempts since JFK, the most nearly successful, the shooting of Ronald Reagan by a disaffected rich kid. Many comparisons have been made between Lincoln and Kennedy, some serious, many frivolous, such as the car Kennedy was riding in when he was shot was a Lincoln, and that one of Lincoln's presidential somebodies was a Kennedy. Today's program begins with Dan Armstrong's critical analysis of the officious cover-up of JFK's assassination. Dearth of a President by Dan Armstrong. Why in the damned world would anyone want to jump back into the morass of lies and suspicions surrounding the assassination of John F. Kennedy? Does it really matter anymore who pulled the trigger or triggers in this most awful of American tragedies? A million hours research have intervened since that black day in Dallas, November 22, 1963, and still no presiding scenario has been resolved. Shouldn't we just let this ugly little sore in American history heal up and scar? Shouldn't we move on to more pressing needs? Why must we keep ticking at this scab, causing it to bleed and bleed again? 10 months after the assassination, in September 1964, the findings of the Warren Commission were made public in a 26-volume report. Simply, the commission had determined that Lee Harvey Oswald was the assassin and that he was working alone. Despite the impeccable reputation of Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren, chairman of the commission, the report was met with considerable criticism almost immediately. This lie has steadily torn the heart out of our democracy. 57 years after the fact, the central casualty of the Warren Commission's charade has been the public trust. Also revealed is the true nature of these last 50 years that could be accurately labeled the age of deceit, an age that still marshals on. Approximately 3 years after the Warren Commission report, New Orleans District Attorney Garrison, at the suggestion of Louisiana Senator Russell Long, brother of the late Huey, who was also assassinated, read the Warren report in its entirety. The glaring inadequacy of the commission's work led Garrison to his well-known and mostly ridiculed investigation of the assassination. Though his research uncovered many loose ends and considerable suggestion of a deep vein of treachery in our own government, Garrison's scream fell primarily on deaf ears, and like the Warren report, dropped quietly into the past. The question of conspiracy, however, would not go away. Gallup polls taken in the early 1970s showed that nearly 80% of Americans believed that Kennedy's assassination was the result of a conspiracy. 70% felt the same about the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. In 1975, House Representative Henry Gonzalez of Texas called for a congressional review of the assassinations of John Kennedy, his brother Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King Jr., and the shooting of George Wallace. There was great reluctance in the old guard to reopen these cases, but in September 1976, after a year of feet-dragging and postponement, the House Select Committee on Assassinations came into being. 2 years later, during which time several key witnesses to the Kennedy assassination met accidental, quote-unquote, deaths or committed suicide, the Committee on Assassinations concluded there had, in fact, been at least one other gunman involved in the shooting of Kennedy, and that this suggested a conspiracy of unknown order. Even though this meant that at least one assassin had got away scot-free, the report was in no way acted upon. No arrests were ever made. No further action was taken. Hardly anyone even seemed to notice or care about the assassination committee's incredibly timid intimations. But this modest congressional admission did give independent researchers hope that the truth could be found and that maybe there was a way to the bottom of this dark crime. In 1992, President George Bush signed into law the John F. Kennedy Assassination Records Collection Act, known as the JFK Act, which called for a 5-member board of reviewers to go through the entire assassination record and open it to the public. At first glance, it might seem that a sincere effort was being made to come to terms with the claims of conspiracy and to answer the needs of a doubtful public. However, in a highly sophisticated and possibly premeditated way, the truth has been doled out to the public by Congress in 10-year bites. And in this light, the work of the Assassination Record Review Board befouls its own water. In Section 6 of the JFK Act, 5 grounds for postponement of public disclosure are cited. The first reason the file can be kept closed to the public is that it might offer a threat to national security by identifying an agent or intelligence source still active in the field. Second, that it would reveal the name of a person who provided confidential information to the government. Third, that the matter would, quote, constitute an unwarranted invasion of personal privacy, unquote, that would outweigh the public's need to know. Fourth, that it would, quote, compromise the existence of an understanding between a government agent and a cooperating individual or a foreign government, unquote, in such a way that it would outweigh the public's right to know. Fifth, that it would, quote, reveal a security or protective procedure currently used, unquote, by the Secret Service or some other government intelligence agency. Lack of trust weighs more heavily on the American people than any specter of enemy infiltration, any confidentiality, any single agent in the field, and fear of double or triple agents gaining access to our war chest of secrets, especially any that existed in the 1960s. Max Holland, who believes Oswald was the single assassin, asked in an American Heritage article, was holding back some of the truth one of the great misjudgments in American history? His answer is that enduring, perhaps ineradicable controversy over the assassination of John Kennedy has helped foster deep alienation, cynicism, and a loss of respect among the American people for their government and the citizens who serve in it. That is perhaps the most lasting and grievous wounds inflicted by Lee Harvey Oswald, quote, unquote. The trust of the people outweighs all other factors. So again, what could they be hiding that is so sensitive? That the CIA is run by a bunch of bunglers? The strength of J. Edgar Hoover's hand in American politics in 1963 and until his death in 1972? The real horror of the COINTELPRO blitz? The shenanigans that surround the Bay of Pigs? Could there really be anything at all to hide if Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone assassin? One must labor to find solid grounds for any secret that is more valuable than the failing trust of the people. Accepting hyperspace aliens, only two imaginably conceivable reasons would prevent every document from being open to the public right now. First would be the true extent to which organized crime played a part in the assassination. Yes, national security would indeed be in jeopardy if we were told organized crime engineered a political coup in 1963, because that organization would surely still be in place today if more legitimized by the power it gained by that coup. Second would be that our own intelligence community, backed by corporate feudal lords and or the military-industrial complex, was responsible for Kennedy's death. And again, national security wavers here due to fear of a populist revolt, because that intelligence community still presides in the shadows with unknown quantities of influence. Both of these ugly possibilities are strongly suggested by the information gathered since the assassination. And in some ways, these two intrigues are one, because if we look closely at the nature of the beast, there is but the subtlest differences between the intelligence community fringe and organized crime. The Iran-Contra scandal was not an aberration, but simply business as usual. Drugs for guns is the modus operandi of the real terrorism that grips and controls not just this country, but perhaps the entire globe. So now we near the sorts of things that cannot be revealed to the American public, probably for fear of revolution or civil war. Yes, just as Lyndon Johnson informed Earl Warren that a Third World War could very likely result if Oswald was not found to be a lone assassin, and quickly, the Assassination Record Review Board today finds the specter of secession weighing in their scales as they contemplate the names of certain agents, certain types of information gathering, special protection methods, and the confidentiality of certain witnesses, because many of these agents are underworld associates. Much of this information gathering is through mafia drug networks, and many of these confidants are mob-linked. Fraternizing with and hiring hoods and drug dealers and gun runners are part of the dark game our intelligence community plays. In fact, the intelligence community is so riddled with criminal contact on its outer edges, it is frightening to imagine, much less know, what goes on at the center. We live in an age of deceit. So why would anyone want to jump back into the morass of lies and suspicions surrounding the assassination of John F. Kennedy? Because it is as good a place as any to start the retelling of American history since the Second World War. because in this so-called information age, information means absolutely nothing if it is based on a bold-faced lie, or more accurately, a nest of bold-faced lies. How can democracy work if the public is informed through half-truths and disinformation? There is an important lesson to be learned here. There is a necessary level of innocence to be advanced through for the sake of a maturing democracy. Because, yes, the sad, sad truth is that the cover-up worked. The act has been successfully removed to the realm of history. It has become an abstract thing, filled with the names of individuals who are either dead or long gone from the scene. Unfortunately, however, the organizations and the ugly network of intelligence that moved those pawns into place most certainly do remain in some form or other. Unresolved, like a spoiled relationship unclosed, tattering in time, we proceed through the 21st century with an unhealing wound at the heart of our group psyche, a wound still bleeding and eating at the core of what we once called the American dream. Every moment this wound is left undressed represents a terrible knot, an unknown, a boiling, unsolved crime that resides at the center of our collective being and spirit of our own country, perhaps the entire world. Every moment the federal archives are left partially closed, we deny, even dismantle, the ideal of democracy in America. And that was The Dearth of a President by Dan Armstrong. Dan Armstrong, son of a U.S. Navy admiral, lived for nearly a decade in Astoria, painting houses and writing books. He contributed a great many remarkable articles to the North Coast Times Eagle, of which I was editor-publisher. He eventually removed himself back to Eugene, where he had coached amateur baseball, and continued to write books that he self-published. John Fitzgerald Kennedy, Lee Harvey Oswald, who was himself assassinated by an underworld figure named Jack Ruby while in police custody, and a Dallas policeman whom Oswald shot the same day as JFK, named J.D. Tippit, were buried the same day, November 25th, which this year of 2021 is Thanksgiving Day. And as much as the USMC would rather disclaim him, Lee Harvey Oswald is the most famous Marine in its 246-year history since its legendary birthday on November 10th, 1775, which ponders the question, does assassinating Abraham Lincoln make John Wilkes Booth America's most famous, or rightly infamous, actor? And now, what happens when a congressman threatens a colleague with violence? By Robert Reich. Last week, Arizona Representative Paul Gosar posted on Twitter and Instagram a photoshopped animated cartoon in which he assassinates Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and attacks President Joe Biden. Gosar says it, quote, symbolizes the battle for the soul of America, unquote, when Congress takes up the president's economic package, which he said includes immigration provisions he opposes. Gosar represents Arizona's 4th Congressional District. Until 2012, a dear friend of mine, Gabrielle Giffords, represented Arizona's 8th Congressional District. I got to know Gabby shortly before she entered politics as a member of the Arizona State House of Representatives in 2001. She then became the youngest woman ever elected to the Arizona Senate And then in 2006, the third woman in history to be elected to represent Arizona in the U.S. House of Representatives. On 8 January 2011, during a public gathering outside a Safeway grocery store in Casa Adobes, Arizona, Gabby was shot in the head by a man firing a 9mm pistol with a 33-round magazine. He hit 19 people and killed six, among them federal judge John Roll and a 9-year-old girl, Christina Taylor Green. The shooter, Jared Lee Lochner, was detained by bystanders until he was taken into police custody. Eventually, after facing more than 50 federal criminal charges, Lochner pleaded guilty to 19 of them to avoid a death sentence. Gabby was evacuated to the University Medical Center of Tucson in critical condition. By the time I was able to see her the following week, she could say a few words. But even now, a decade later, after the most intense and courageous personal effort at rehabilitation I have ever witnessed, she continues to struggle with language and has lost half her vision in both eyes. Gabby resigned from Congress in 2012. Why did Lochner try to assassinate her? No one will ever know for sure. Authorities found in his safe an envelope that bore the handwritten words, Giffords. My assassination, and I planned ahead. By all accounts, including his own, he was growing increasingly delusional. He had amplified on his social media accounts several extremist right-wing tropes. In March 2010, 10 months before the shooting, former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin had posted a map of representatives in Congress who had voted in favor of the Affordable Care Act. The map marked each district with a set of crosshairs. Palin promoted the map by tweeting, "Don't retreat, instead reload," quote unquote. One of those crosshairs targeted Gabby. Although no direct connection was ever established between Palin's map and Gabby's shooting, surely, Palin's violent rhetoric contributed to a climate of political violence in America in which a delusional man would mark Gabby for assassination. Gabby herself had expressed concern about Palin's map. Just as surely, Palin's inflammatory post was a step toward increasingly violent political rhetoric on the way to Donald Trump and the insurrection of 6 January. Last Friday, a group of House Democrats introduced a resolution to censure Gosar for posting his video. The motion was introduced by Representative Jackie Speier, co-chair of the Democratic Women's Caucus, and 9 other lawmakers. For that member to post such a video on his official Instagram account and use his official congressional resources in the House of Representatives to further violence against elected officials goes beyond the pale, the group said. As the events of January 6th have shown, such vicious and vulgar messaging can and does foment actual violence. The House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, has so far been silent on Gosar's video. The group of House Democrats who introduced the resolution condemned McCarthy's silence, calling it tacit approval and just as dangerous, quote unquote. America is experiencing increasingly virulent politics and violent political threats. The New York Times reports that at a conservative rally in western Idaho last month, a young man stepped up to a microphone to ask when he could start killing Democrats. "When do we get to use the guns?" he said, as the audience applauded. "How many elections are they going to steal before we kill these people?" The local state representative, a Republican, later called it a fair question. According to the New York Times, violent threats against lawmakers are on track to double this year. Republicans who break party ranks and defy Trump have come to expect death threats, often incited by their own colleagues who have denounced them as traitors. unless those at the highest levels of government who foment or encourage violence, or who remain conspicuously silent as others do, are held accountable, no one in political life will be safe. Censure is not enough for Gosar. He should be expelled from the House. And that was What Happens When a Congressman Threatens a Colleague with Violence, by Robert Reich, who is a former U.S. Secretary of Labor and professor of public policy at the University of California at Berkeley, and the author of Saving Capitalism for the Many, Not the Few, and The Common Good. His new book, The System, Who Rigged It, How We Fix It, is out now. And he wrote this for The Guardian. 30 years ago, on November 21st, 1991, a young Frenchman named Gerard d'Aberville, of old French aristocracy, his father was a baron, completed an awesome solitary trek across the Pacific Ocean in a kayak, which he rode all the way from Japan to Astoria, Oregon. His epic voyage was more than 6,300 nautical miles, and it lasted 4 months. He left Japan in July that year. He capsized about 24 or more times in weather fair and foul during his solo transit of Earth's largest ocean. His last few days at sea were among the harrowest because of a string of gale intensity storms just off the northwest coast of the USA, which caused him to capsize at least once and caused a gash across his face. He was towed across the Columbia River Bar, infamously known as the graveyard of the Pacific, by a local fish boat, the Miss Mary, and first came ashore on the Washington side at Ilwaco. Then he rode his weather-battered kayak across the 4 mile river to Astoria, where he was ceremoniously greeted at the Columbia River Maritime Museum. He was compared on that occasion to aviator Charles Lindbergh and his 1927 solo flight over the Atlantic Ocean from the U.S. to Paris, which was overblown rhetoric that missed the point. His arduously awesome voyage was more mindful of ancient Polynesians who crossed the vast spaces of the Pacific, for the most part east to west, as d'Aberville paddled, on voyages of exploration and settlement, traversing hundreds, even thousands, of oceanic miles between known and unknown groups of islands, navigating by wind and stars. It is not at all unlikely that many of these ancient oceanic voyagers made landfall in the southerly regions of this hemisphere, as young d'Aberville was more recently able to do up here on the 45th parallel. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk is engineer for this program. Last week, I erroneously claimed that Vietnam veterans are the last survivors of the USA's 20th century wars, completely neglecting the Persian Gulf War veterans of 1990 and 91. Instead, I more or less lumped them with this century's post 9/11 wars in the Middle East, in particular seeming to meld both wars against Iraq dictator Saddam Hussein by father and son presidents Bush, literally across two millennia. I apologize to the veterans I slighted, alive and dead. The pandemic scourge is once again sweeping through Europe. Be very careful on this side of the world. Rethink your usual plans for mass gatherings at Thanksgiving, which might result in lethal thanklessness. Stay the course. Vaccinate and abdicate from crowded holidays and other gatherings that could very well instigate and imitate Europe's viral resurgence. And happy birthday to Margaret Almeida, November 17th.